In our last session, we talked about treaties and the Indian Act. The assimilation policies were institutionalized through the Indian Act and in the residential school system. And before we get to that, a warning. This conversation will detail specific instances of abuse and may be triggering to some. For survivors, including intergenerational survivors, please reach out to someone you trust to help navigate the emotions that may come up during this conversation. I'm going to acknowledge once again that we are on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. It was May 2021 that Canadians got a stark reminder about the harmful effects of Canada's assimilation policies.
There's a lot of unanswered questions. Where did these missing children go? We were brought together. We were shared the unthinkable, the horrific initial findings that they could very well be children beneath the surface.
Just about 4 hours northeast of here is Kamloops, British Columbia. And it was at the site of the former residential school that as many as 215 school children were buried in unmarked graves. Since then, First Nations across Canada have reported evidence of the remains of more than 2,300 children in suspected unmarked graves at or near former residential schools. The number, though, is believed to be much higher. Phil Fontaine is one of the first residential school survivors to publicly detail his experiences as a small boy. In fact, it was in a landmark interview with the CBC.
My grade three class, if there were 20 boys in this particular class, every single one of the 20 would have experienced what I experienced.
Phil, I remember that interview when it aired on television so vividly. I think because it really was the first time such a well-known person as you were in 1991 was revealing such a shocking truth. And it angers me that so much of Canada either didn't know it or chose to not know it. I certainly did not know these details, didn't learn it in school. Which must be even harder for you to know that you're educating and re-educating, as we've been saying in the past episodes. Tell me, if you can, your earliest memory of being at home and being told you're going to go to this school far away.
I was well aware of the residential school that was situated on a reserve. As the Fort Alexander Indian Reserve, so the school was the Fort Alexander Indian Residential School. Because one Sunday, my dad, my late father and late mother, and my late sister Thelma and I went on a sleigh, to go visit the brothers at the school. And the team of horses broke through the ice on the way, so my father bundled us up, including my mom, and took us up the bank to go wait for him. And he got the horses out safely, went up the bank to bring us down, back down onto the sleigh, and carried on to the school. And that was to visit my older siblings that were students at the school. And so I knew how these visits were managed. At one point, they were on our side of the school. They called it the boys' playroom. So that's where they used to visit. Then, at some point, that place for visiting was transferred to the Preventorium, they called it. The Preventorium was going to be a place for students suffering from TB. and they were going to be brought in from different communities. And on Sundays, that's where the parents would gather to visit children.
I know every school was different in how they policed, if I can use that term, those visits. Some didn't even allow the children to see their parents or their siblings on a weekend, or yours did.
Sundays. And as I said, the time was spent in the preventorium. Those, you know, the families would be situated in different parts of the boys' playroom. And that all changed when the community built a community hall in 1951. Yeah, and so that then, all of those visits with parents took place at the hall, the band hall, we called it, on Sundays.
So your school was close enough to your home. We know, again, that was not the case for so many children taken hundreds of miles, kilometers from their homes. Was it something you looked forward to, going to the school?
Well, I was intrigued is not the word, but I wondered about the school. It was big, and had, you know, 100-150 boys and girls at the school. And the day I went, my mom, because my dad was not well, took me to the school, and I had soup with my brother, Clem, and his cousin, Rudy, and the nun came over and asked me my name, and I said Larry Fontaine, because that was my name, and my mom had disappeared. My mom was no longer around. Then I realized that I was at the school and my mom was back at home. So it was Sundays were the toughest part of my time there in the early years of my schooling at the residential school, because my mother would come and we'd have 2 hours. And every time it was time for her to leave, I was the youngest, I was a little boy.
How old?
I was 6, turned 7 at my first year. So I was the baby boy. And my sister Thelma was not old enough for res school. And Audrey was born June 51. So I was the youngest. And it was just tragic for me. I mean, I don't want to embellish this thing, but I would cry like you wouldn't believe. I'd try and run away from the crowd that was going back to the school. And I remember on one visit, Brother Morin took me on his shoulder, carried me back to the school, and I was wailing the whole time.
Wailing because a child would miss their parent, first of all.
Missed home.
But also, what was the environment like inside that school that you can remember?
Church, every day, every morning. In the winter, if it was too cold, we'd have mass, daily mass, in the school chapel. And then you'd come back, you'd have breakfast, and then played around a bit, and then classrooms for the rest of the time. And it was just a time of confusion. I wondered what this was all about. I was learning to read, I was learning to count, and I saw cousins at the school, and I was scared of the dark, because these dormitories were dark. And I was never very good at handling the dark. And so...
Darkness takes on totally different meaning when there's also abusive elements unfolding wherever, especially for a child, I can imagine.
Well, the discipline was so completely different than what I experienced at home, right? Larry became Philip, right? So
they changed your name.
Well, my certificate, my baptismal certificate, it's Larry Philip Fontaine. So my mom and dad chose Larry as my first name. When she comes to visit me, the Sunday after I was admitted to school, the sister pretty much announced to my mom that Philip would be my name in the school. But she said, but his name is Larry. Well, we think it's better if his name was Philip. So I became Philip. And I didn't appreciate the significance of that, other than the nun's explanation that Philip was an apostle, but Larry wasn't, so it's just keeping within the teachings of the school and the church.
And of course, stripping a parent of the right to name their own child or that.
Yeah, and, but it was always a struggle, just tore me up inside to see my mom leave, right?
Did you ever reveal to her any of the things that were happening, or was there not an opportunity? Or did you really just keep it all inside until you revealed it so publicly?
Well, there's two aspects to this, or three. The separation, which was the most tragic in my experience for the first 7 years of my schooling at the residential school. The separation from my mom and my family, because her father died during my first year at residential school. So no more father, but my mom. Right? And I never got over that during my lifetime.
Did they allow you to go to the funeral?
Oh yes, yeah, the wake was at our home. It was traditional to have it at the home. And we had the wake at the home, then the funeral at the church, packed church, and then back to school. And it was all confusing when my mom came to the school to tell her sons that their father was gone. And I wondered what that meant, he was gone. Yeah. And the nun explained to me what my mom meant. And I don't think it was something that I could understand. Right? Because, I just couldn't understand that. So that stayed with me for a lifetime. We weren't very far from home. They could have allowed us to go home on weekends, for example, spend family time on the weekends and come back, but that wasn't part of the school policy. So that was very, very difficult. And then I was a picky eater, very picky eater. And I didn't like a lot of the food. And I always struggled. And there were times when the boys threw food on the floor. And I may have done that at one point. But then someone at one of our, lunchtime, they called it dinner, someone had thrown a sandwich, bread and meat, and the nun blamed me for it. She made me eat the goddamn thing. And the floor is dirty. the food was that had been on the floor was dirty, and she made me eat it. She called me a king, you see, because I was a spoiled guy in her views, and said, told the other boys there, watch the king eat. And I was forced to eat that.
Humiliating.
It was humiliating. It was dreadful. It was, man. And you couldn't cry, right? It was, you just had to take your lumps, the punishment. So that happened a number of times. And I told my mom about it. And so the two nuns came to my mother and me. And the superior asked me if it was true that this nun had been mean to me and had forced me to do that. And my mom is there, and I'm too goddamn chicken, right? To say, yeah, she's been mean to me. She's been mean to me. I said, no. And that was the end of it. So it was, in effect, carte blanche for her at that point. And that was, that happened more than once.
These tales now, since the whole residential school reality is now common knowledge, the tales of abuse are so horrifying, absolutely horrifying. And I can only imagine for you and so many who suffered it, how challenging it is to recognize the importance of revealing it out loud, mm-hmm. and yet you're still coping with it. I can clearly see that.
Mm-hmm. And I would never suggest that my experiences in res school were worse than others. I mean, what I experienced was not unique in any way. It was something that other students experienced to different degrees, the abuse. The physical abuse, for example, was pretty routine. Yeah, pretty routine. And, yeah. And then the sexual abuse was also not something that was unique to me or two boys or, you know, classmates. I mean, there was a whole number of the boys that were experienced what I experienced. And in my young mind, I had an appreciation that what I was experiencing wasn't right. It wasn't right. And the other boys, of course, thought about it or figured it out in the same way I did, that it wasn't right. But our coping mechanism was to laugh about it, was to tease each other briefly about, you know, the experience. And that's just how it went on. And then you couple that with bullying, and bullies that were no different than the priest, right? And you couldn't tell anyone about that kind of stuff, right? I never told my mom, ever, or my siblings.
But in 1990, you told Barbara Fromm that, you know, every child in your grade three class...
In my classroom.
...had been abused.
The boys, yeah. By the same...
Sexually abused, physically abused?
No. Sexual. It was sexual. And it was a weird... it's a weird experience. You know, it's like... it was like open confession and then your body, right?
And you found now that this is all so public. It took you 30 years, though, of fighting that to make this something nobody can deny now.
Well, the people that deny it, and there are some, would be based on the degree of the abuse. How extensive was it? Was it really abuse? Was it just a misguided kind of interpretation on our part that maybe it wasn't? Maybe what he was doing was really quite helpful and part of our hygiene, right? And so that's how we figured it out. And I remember my oldest brother was gone now, telling me about his own experience when the priest wanted to engage him in this ritual. And he told my oldest brother, Jim, said, "Father, I have a girlfriend, for goodness sakes. I have a girlfriend, you know?"
So you did. You were able to share this with your family, but much later or at the time?
Well, it's funny, you know. The boys would get together, siblings and others, and it was a big joke. It was a joke. We just laughed about it.
The coping mechanism.
It was to me, I'm sure it was to others, and you know, your name would be written in on a piece of paper, that the teacher would get the name, and come to you, and that was after another classmate had come back from his little adventure, so you'd go and. And the boys would whisper what was about to occur.
Everybody knew.
On the boys' side, yes. The girls maybe as well. But they never concerned themselves about it. But we had the word for it, and that's how we described this. And
what was your word for it?
Easy beginning go. Easy beginning go.
Is that Ojibwe?
Ojibwe, yeah.
What does it mean?
You were washed. You were cleaned. Easy beginning go. Or you go easy beginning go, or you're going to get washed. Or something. Words like that, yeah.
Was there fear attached to that?
The first time? No, I don't think there was ever any fear. It was a sense of more embarrassment, more about wondering why, and it was a ritualistic kind of moment. You told your stories, right? To cleanse your mind of these impure thoughts and thinking about girls, for example. And so to clear your soul of the impurities, and the only way you could do that was to clean yourself as well. And so that was the ritual.
The priest is standing there.
Well, standing there, standing and helping.
You know, I hate even using the word story, and I hate using the word school, to be honest. Uh-huh. This is a government-sanctioned institutions that 150,000 children made their way through. Yours is one story. that is just a horror to hear. Mm-hmm.
So my name is Laura Arndt. I'm joining you today at the Mohawk Institute. My mother was one of many who attended the school during its 140 years of operation. And there's a lot of, as many would say, bad history here, especially in this basement. I think of my role now as the secretary at LEED. I am working with survivors associated with 57 communities across Canada who attended the school. 15,000 attended the school is the estimation in its 140 years of operation. Think of 140 years of children walking in the front door, coming down here and starting their experience in this basement. They would play down here, if that's what you call it. They would eat down here, and they'd also come down here for punishment. I think of my own mom in this school, and it took her 70 years to come back just to stand outside. Lasted here about 40 minutes and said, I gotta go. I think of the role of the Anglican Church, the New England Company, Canada, in the operation of the school. It's the longest running. So the records are everywhere. 15,000 kids, as I said. Over the course of our work, we've been able to track the names of about 4,600 children. I mean, the saddest and scariest part in the history of the school is kids didn't realize how close they were to home. Like, they didn't realize how close they were to home. Phil Fontaine, whether he will remember me or not, and I sat at an event like almost 20 years ago. And it was Holocaust survivor event. And he spoke as an Indigenous person. And when he sat and he spoke about genocide, and I like to say that I think he was using the word genocide before the TRC, and he was using it before murdered and missing. And I think the pairing of Holocaust survivors and our genocide, part of that is these buildings stand as a way of saying you can't erase history. If you raise the buildings and burn them to the ground or remove them, it creates a space for denialism. Show me where. And I think this space gives me great unease. Like, I find it hard sometimes to catch my breath down here. But having said that, people need to feel that. And you don't feel that when you're roaming through a book. You don't find that when you go through a museum and you see a display. You feel that when you come down here and you look in this room and you imagine row on row of kids. You imagine a bowl of mush. And you imagine that potentially there could be maggots in it because it's been sitting. You sit here and you imagine little girls who've been sexually abused, little boys who've been sexually abused. And you think that this is a school, and the people who were doing that were the people who are running this school. And this wasn't a school. This wasn't. This was the space where they broke and tore children from culture, identity. They tore children from family and community, and they tore children away from belonging and history, like their history, their people.
The first residential schools were 1867, lasted over 100 years to 1996. It's when the last school closed. What was the purpose of these schools in the beginning?
Well, the way it was described in the documents that you can research was that it was to deal with the so-called Indian problem. In the early days, the relationship was quite a positive one with the colonizers. But as time went on and more settlers came, the Indians were getting in the way. They were protesting, they were resisting. So instead of being allies and teachers and helpmates to the fur trade, they became a problem. So then people started to talk about, how do we deal with this problem? There was one famous Oxford professor who was in charge of the colonial state. And he suggested, well, you could exterminate them, you could contain them, you can assimilate them. There's different strategies you could use, and he presented that to the
government. One of them was also slavery.
And
was
slavery,
it not?
Yeah, right. Yeah, you could enslave them. And then the Soviet government started to study this thing, and there was another guy called Bagel. He went down to the U.S. He was looking at the industrial schools there. He came back to Canada, and he suggested, well, what would work, he thought, was residential schools. So you could break the bond between the child and the parent, the child and the community, don't allow them to speak their languages or do anything to do with the savagery of their culture. And he suggested that. And then there was another guy called Nicholas Davin. He came along and he said, well, how are we going to do this? The best way probably would get the churches to run them, because the churches were all competing with one another anyway to convert the native people to Christianity. And the Catholic Church had the biggest presence, and they had the biggest influence, the biggest lobby for the government. So they, in fact, ended up running about 70% of the schools. But a variety of churches were entered into contracts with the federal government to run these schools.
And the more students a school had, the more money.
Yes, it was based on per capita funding. So the more students you had, the more money you got. So that incentivized the churches to go out and get as many children as they could. And they employed the services of the RCMP, they employed the services of the Indian agent and others to gather as many children as they could to bring to the school. And that would ensure that, they were funded. However, the funding was so miserable. It was $180 per child per year in the 30s. And, you know, you hear people say, oh, those schools were designed to help the native population to compete and to participate in Canadian society. Not true. And the funding tells you the story, because $180 per child per year compared to any other institutional setting, the school for the deaf or reform schools for non-Indigenous children or prisons, were at least three times that amount. So the funding was terribly inadequate by any comparator. And then the regulations were so interesting, because provincial schools run by provincial governments for non-Indigenous children were governed by provincial legislation. And if you look at that legislation, there would be approximately 90 pages of regulations. The Manitoba Act in particular, I looked at 91 pages of regulations. You look at the Indian Act and what regulations were there for industrial schools, for 102 or 103 years, there was approximately four pages of regulations. And of course, these regulations deal with discipline, qualifications for teachers, curriculum, the school year expectations, building requirements, codes, etc. None of that applied to these Indian residential schools. So if you look at the regs and you look at the money, it tells the story. These schools were not for education. They were for containment and for assimilation, basically. Otherwise, had the motive been to educate these children, they would have treated them the same as other schools, so that they could come out the other end being reading and writing and educated, so they could compete in the society and obtain jobs and participate. But that wasn't the purpose.
And people may not realize that there was no choice. Children, it was mandatory on reserves for children to go to these schools.
Well, the church lobbied for legislation for this per capita reason, to get as many kids in as possible. So in the 20s then, the government passed legislation through the Indian Act that required the children to go to school from age 4 to 16. And what was interesting, if it wasn't enforced, when parents signed the application form, they essentially handed over control of their child. So if the kid wanted to leave or ran away, it was the school that controlled that child. So the child would be forced back into the school till they were 16.
My name is Delia Opikiku. I'm a Cree from the Kano Lake Indian Reserve in Saskatchewan. And I have practiced law in out of Toronto, with clients across the country. Regarding the effects of assimilation, there was an effort from the government historically to attempt to assimilate indigenous people to become similar to the settlers. And there was a lot of damage because of that. And one of the ways they did that was through the Indian residential schools, where people like myself were put into residential schools with the view to losing our languages and to only speak in English, to lose our culture and customs, and to adopt the ways of which historically they used the term, the ways of the white man. And that occurred extensively in the later part of the 19th century, all through the 20th century. But by the middle part of the 20th century, indigenous people started to fight against that. They wanted to continue their own customs, their own ways, and to keep their languages. The bureaucrats and some of the church officials believed that it was the only way to deal with indigenous people, which was to separate them from their families, from their culture, the customs, and build these schools. And they built schools across the country where we were removed from our families and put into these residential schools. And they continued from the 19th century right until about 1996, which is really not too long ago. That impact is horrendous for some people. I was a deputy chief adjudicator of the independent assessment process, which was created as a tribunal under the class action lawsuit settlement that certain Indian resident school survivals had pursued. And out of about five categories in the settlement agreement, one of them was the creation of this tribunal. And we heard this, and the tribunal allowed for individuals to pursue claims of physical, sexual, and other wrongs that were made against them. And there was just so many claims pursued. There was horrendous acts of sexual and abuse, and sexual and physical abuse against people while they were in school.
And a clarification here. When I entered residential school, I wasn't forced. It was a decision taken by my mother and father that we would enter the residential school.
Had they gone to residential school?
My mom and dad both went to the school.
The same school?
Same school. I mean, I would never know what their experiences were like. I know three incidents were of abuse, physical, by priests. My aunt, my mom's younger sister, was stripped by the priest and whipped in front of the girls, her peer group, and actually whipped. And so I asked an older woman on the reserve. She was present there. And I said, what did you do? What did the girls do? Nothing, she says. Couldn't do nothing. We cried when they witnessed this. And why did the priest do that? She says, we don't know, maybe because she was pretty. A pretty young woman, my mom's younger sister. And yeah. And then another time, my father, late father, and his two friends were caught stealing candy from the priest. And, you know, each of them put their hand in this little hole. I think that they tell me, guys that knew about this, that it was designed that way so that boys would get caught. And the three of them, Pete and my dad, JB, and Alec, were caught. They were whipped, right? But strapped, actually, major strapped by this priest.
And this is, Kathleen, where I want you to give people some perspective on when it became a movement to fight back, to actually hold someone accountable for the experiences of over 150,000 children?
Well, what happened was fairly recent history, as you probably know. After the famous interview with Barbara Frum, Phil told the story of his school, a lot of people started to react because this was well known within the Indigenous community, but certainly not in the non-Indigenous community. And so people started going, talking to their lawyers, and a whole lot of cases started to be filed in the courts, to the extent that eventually there was thousands. There was over up to 15,000 cases, class actions as well as individual lawsuits. And the Chief Justice, who was in charge of managing the residential school claims, said that this will take 56 years of court time to resolve all these cases, and nothing else will be able to be heard. So it was a crisis in the courts. So he said something has to be done, and then that's when it was diverted over to a talk of a settlement or an alternate dispute resolution type of process. And that was in the early 2000s, in about 2003.
And outline your role, first of all, in that significant part of Canadian history.
Right. Well, I had been involved with another case involving Indigenous women who were denied equal pay for doing the same work as non-Indigenous women outside reserve. And so I was asked to look at what an alternative dispute resolution would look like and what could be done. And that, the AFN asked me to do that. So I got involved in the early stages, and Canada produced an alternative dispute resolution
process,
yeah, that everybody would. So in other words, it was, they laid it on. It was without consultation, which is sort of pro forma for the government. People rejected it. The poster girl for how terrible it was this lovely elderly woman who had, when she was at a reserve school, her mother had died and they wouldn't let her go to the funeral, so she ran away to go to the funeral. And when she got back, she was severely punished. And so she took an action under this ADR process, and they said, no, sorry, it's not covered. And so she appealed it. Make a long story short, the government spent over $26,000 to deny her a claim that would have been worth $2,500. So it became very obvious, not only to those of us working on this, but to the government itself, that this, there's something fundamentally wrong. So what happened then was the AFN and the University of Calgary Law Faculty worked together to do a conference, and we invited experts from all over the world.
And Phil, you were the Grand Chief at that time?
He was the National Chief of Canada. Right. And we co-chaired that conference. And we asked one question. We said, will this ADR result in reconciliation, because that was the government's stated objective. So we had medical people, we had judges, lawyers, survivors, elders, Native studies experts, psychiatrists, a whole range,
Catholic,
multidisciplinary.
A Catholic bishop, Mother Superior.
Yeah.
It was a very diverse group.
And even government civil servants and the man that was in charge of the residential school file, everybody said, no, it won't. It's terribly deficient. So then at the last day of the conference, Mario Dion, who was the head of the residential school file civil servant, said to Phil, okay, you do it. And he provided sufficient funding. Phil said, okay, let's do it, and asked me to head up the project, which I did. And we took a lot of those experts and people and worked over several months. We went over to Ireland to see what they were doing. We wrote up an Irish report. We wrote up the AFN report. We said, this is what has to be done. Truth Commission, healing funds, commemoration for the elderly, an apology, loss of language and culture to be acknowledged, and of course, the abuse claims for individual students. And there has to be an archive and a research center. That kind of thing was in the AFN report.
So much further than mainstream law.
Oh, yes, because all the government wanted to do was what British law says, that you can get money if somebody hurts you. And how do you measure that? You go to the marketplace and see if there's a replacement value for what you've lost. But the problem is, when you've lost a childhood, when you've lost your culture, when you've lost your language, when you've lost your dignity, when you've, you know, been treated as Phil has described, there's nothing in the marketplace that you can compare that to. And what we also heard from survivors on our coast-to-coast-to-coast consultation period of time we took was that they wanted to tell their stories and be heard, number one. Two, they wanted to heal. Three, they wanted to commemorate those that had passed. Four, they wanted to be treated with dignity and equality. They didn't even talk about compensation. We said, yeah, well, what about compensation? But that was all that the mainstream legal system could provide, actually, under British common law. So what was needed then was an Indigenous approach and a transformative approach, which the National Chief insisted upon.
So that was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission changed everything, really, was the turning
And that was,
point.
We knew, would be the legacy piece, because money comes and goes. The other elements were very important, you know, to have ceremony, et cetera, in individual communities and nationally. But we knew the legacy would be the Truth Commission and what would follow from that. And indeed, that, I think, is, we can safely say, is what has happened.
And what would you say changed as a result of that for Indigenous peoples to be heard that way?
Our stories, and some of them were horrific, unpleasant to people that had no idea about residential schools and what residential schools were about. And there was disbelief that this actually happened. And so we knew and understood that what we were going to have to do was to go out and, in effect, spread the word, inform and educate Canadians about the residential school experience in such a way that it would compel Canadians to accept what we were saying as the truth. And it was a very difficult undertaking.
There were certainly references during that time of the unmarked graves, the suspected unmarked graves, the thousands of children. Then, as we've said, it was Kamloops that really brought that and was a turning point, became a turning point for the country to wake up to this. Explain the reality in the years that have unfolded since the Kamloops announcement of the 215, the ground penetrating work that's happening to determine actual numbers. Put that in perspective for us.
Well, the point you make about Kamloops and the 215 unmarked graves is true. That became a turning point in our in the conversation or conversations we were having with Canadians about the residential school experience, and that we were being truthful, we were being open and honest about these stories. But that's a small piece of this larger story.
If I'm talking to somebody about unmarked burials, I always start from the context of there's a part of Canada's history that has been hidden for a very long time. And people like to understand and believe that Canada is a wonderful place and it's a perfect place and the best place in the world to live. And I'm not saying I challenge that. I don't. I love the country I live in. I love the fact that I'm in a country where I can come to work every day and challenge the facts, and I'm not, you know, I'm not threatened with my life. So I want to start there. This isn't about you have to love Canada or hate Canada. It's that you have to understand the tension of what it is to live in Canada. And then I will say some of the history includes the Indian residential school system. So then they started taking children, and then they started strengthening the legislation. But the problem in part of this is the systems in the schools were underfunded. A lot of the people that were brought in with religious beliefs and faith-based beliefs and cultural beliefs that we were savages. that we were uneducated. We needed to be converted to God. And because we were seen in this frame, we were less than human. And it opened the door for violence. And that violence became violence that could have started simply by cutting braids when kids walked into school, stripping them of clothing that they were used to, in European clothing. Then it could be the stripping of self-worth by being very aggressive and very verbally abusive, and then further tearing down through physical and sexual abuse. And then sometimes it goes too far, and children died. And sometimes things happen from abuse, and young girls got pregnant, babies were born, and you can't have that coming out, so more children died. And then you overpack schools because there wasn't enough money to run the schools. And influenza happened, and thousands of children died. And then you started feeding children contaminated meats with tuberculosis and other diseases, more children died. Unmarked burials is a two-edged sword. We can look for the anomalies in the ground, and we can look for records and documents. The anomalies in the ground will tell us who died, and we can work to bring them home. The records and documents tell us how they died. They tell us when they came into the school. They tell us what happened to them while they were at the school, in some cases, and then nothing. So we're then able to start making the connections you need to connect to understand who really died here. But I think in talking to people in Canada, there's a lot of denialism. So there's a lot of people that says we're not telling the truth. We have bad memories. They're old, they don't remember correctly. The fact is people do remember correctly, and there are records that show that they remember correctly. The problem is that because this history hasn't been told in this country, people can't begin to wrap their head around what it that this country could do something like that. That the church that is the source of their foundation and their hope could be part of something so heinous that it would involve the death of children, the abuse of children, and unmarked burials of children. And so it's easier to deny it than to do the work. And I often think of it as grief. A lot of people struggle when they're managing grief that they can't deal with it, so they just pretend things don't happen. And I think when I think of non-Indigenous people denying that the schools and the history existed, I think it's the grief of having to let go of a belief system that holds the value of this country so high that it can't be challenged. And I think learning how to walk through and work through that grief, we get to the other side of, it happened. How do we make sure it never happens again?
Kamloops wasn't breaking news, as they say.
No.
This had been known since 1907, actually, when a fellow called Dr. Peter Bryce, he was the medical officer for the federal government in charge of looking at the health and well-being of Indigenous children in residential schools.
1907. So sort of the first whistleblower.
That's right. And he saw these appalling conditions. Tuberculosis was raging through the country, but it was particularly egregious in Indian residential schools. He wrote in his report that 25% overall of kids were dying in residential schools. 25% of the enrollment were dying. And he said in some situations, 69% of children.
The entire student population of the school had perished.
Yeah, yeah. And so he wrote this up and he submitted it to Duncan Campbell Scott, the guy we talked about earlier. And Campbell Scott deep-sixed the report, refused to publish it. And he said, we will carry on in this per capita funding model, which incentivized the church to bring in even more kids that were sick into the schools, which spread the tuberculosis even worse. And don't forget, the environment in these schools was poor food, poor ventilation, overcrowding, and children who were already in a precarious emotional and psychological state. So this is the environment. So Dr. Bryce blew the whistle. And when the government failed to publish his report and they actually fired him, he then wrote a book about this. So I mean, Kamloops, all that the Kamloops revelation was these bodies are out there
And they're buried around residential schools. And in fact, in our school, we've identified these anomalies, which we think are the graves of children, because where else they go? The other thing that's important, Lisa, is the budget was so meager for these schools, $180 per child per year, is that they didn't have the funds to send the bodies of the children home either, even if they wanted to. So these children were buried there. And then the fact of them being unmarked demonstrates, you know, the lack of course, care and concern and the dignity of the lives of these children.
So, so they were largely, of the thousands, we don't really know an actual number, obviously, but the disease, as you describe it, was so rampant that so many of these kids were dying, and probably just for speed and disrespect.
Well, the TRC established registries. They were able to actually discover over 2,000 deaths that were registered. Cause of death, the child's name, where they were from, over 2,000. Then there was the unnamed registry where children, the school would just report, well, we had six children die or two children died or whatever, and then without names. And in that registry, there's well over 1,000 names. And then there was the children that were sent home. And Dr. Bryce said of the children that were sent home, 69% of them died at home or they were sent to some other facility. So, you know, the numbers could be very high. Whether they were buried or not around residential schools, we don't know. But we certainly know the numbers in residential schools is probably close in the TRC estimated about 6,000, but provably over 2,600 that are actually registered. And then there's these unregistered deaths.
The school that my grandmother attended in St. Boniface, the St. Boniface Industrial School, that was modeled on the industrial schools in the United States. So the federal official that was sent to study the U.S. Model.
That was Nicholas Davin, yeah.
Came back and was praising the industrial school model. So that's when industrials came to be. And the one my grandmother attended in St. Boniface, their student lists are really well documented. Names, age, where they were from, if they died, the cause of death, and the communities they were from. They have all of the names on this school registry. And every child that died in the school was buried at the St. Boniface Cathedral Cemetery. There are two cemeteries, newer one on Archibald, the older one in front of the former basilica there. And they were buried in amongst the community people that were buried there. Right? So according to their records, there are about 6,000 people that were buried in that grave.
Just there? Grave,
yeah. And all of the kids that died at the industrial school were buried there. So those graves became unmarked graves, just like my great-grandfather's grave there. He wasn't a student, but he died at the St. Boniface Hospital in 1902. He's buried there. We don't know where. But I found his brother and his nephew buried at the more recent, the newer grave.
There seems, we could literally do six full episodes just on this subject, but there's a perception that Métis and Inuit children were not dragged into the residential school system, and yet they very much were. Can you put them in the picture, the reality, for children from Métis communities?
Well, there was Métis children in Indian residential schools, not as many as the status Indian children, because they were designed for status Indian children. But if Métis children were in the area or their parents sent them there, they were registered. Often their names actually didn't appear on the registry because the government didn't fund Métis children. Inuit children went to mission schools in the north, and they were definitely funded by the federal government, and they were residential schools, and they were under the settlement agreement and the Métis, well, even white children that went to residential schools were covered by the settlement agreement.
That would surprise people to know that white children were at these schools.
We had claimants that were white.
Yeah. Well, maybe their parents worked at the school and lived on the school grounds or lived in the reserve or nearby and sent their or had their children there, and their children were able to claim compensation under the settlement agreement for the common experience payment, as well as if they were abused, they could claim that.
It's not about money, but in real terms, what did the settlement look like for each person or who'd gone to a residential school?
Well, first of all, as a lawyer, I'd say, sure, it's about money. That's the way the legal system has people account for what they do wrong. If somebody crashes in your car or beats you up or whatever, you're entitled to have that person called to account. And the way that we do that in our system is we measure that in money. So, and it's important because it hurts, at least theoretically, the person who's done the harm. So money is not unimportant, but the point that we're making and the point that was so important in the settlement agreement was that it's much more than that. It was about, like I said, the telling of the story, the healing that was required, the dignity restoration that was needed, the equality that was required in order for people to come away from this with a sense that it was worthwhile, that they could feel that somehow that they had brought accountability to their lives.
Part of that was the need for an apology.
Sure.
From the church.
Absolutely.
So, Phil, tell me, when did the Catholic Church basically first acknowledge the reality of what had unfolded in those schools?
If we do it in the context of the orders that ran these schools and who was the first, was the Oblate Order in 1991. They issued an apology. And the Oblates ran the largest percentage of the residential schools in Canada. And they acknowledged the wrongs and the harms that they inflicted on people. But
refused to give over documents that would have helped in some of these cases.
They did in large measure withhold documents. I don't know if it was done deliberately or they didn't have the resources themselves to know what to do with the documents they had. For example, when I was in Ottawa, I used to spend a fair bit of time, even as national chief, at the National Archives for the Oblate Order. And they would show me fascinating artifacts, magazines, books. I mean, the Oblates, or Oblates, were proficient as they went about their business of evangelization. They learned the languages, the indigenous languages. They wrote these languages. They composed hymn books and prayer books in indigenous languages.
Languages that I think it's important to say you were not allowed to speak inside the walls of those schools.
We were discouraged, for sure. Were we ever punished severely for speaking our language? I'm not aware of that in our school. Interestingly enough,
in other schools, I've spoken to people who had pins put in their tongues if they spoke their own language. What about culpability of the church?
So in terms of language, in our school, it was essentially a language school for the missionaries. There were two priests that were incredibly proficient in speaking the Ojibwe language. And so they brought other missionaries, priests and brothers, come and learn the Ojibwe language right at our school. And there are pictures of these priests that were there studying the language. And many of them would then go out after they had become proficient in the language to go out and recruit. Spread the word. And they would preach on Sundays in Ojibwe. And they were very good.
It's a fascinating, almost a PR campaign, yes. If you will, to win over the people that clearly the church wanted to
They were in control.
Convert.
They were in control in the community.
What about as far as compensation from the church during this process, Kathleen?
Well, you see, the Catholic Church, the way it organizes itself, made it very, very difficult from a liability perspective, because a lot of people, as you probably recall, were saying, well, the Vatican is so wealthy, they should be able to pay a lot of money, way more money than the survivors are getting. But the reality from a legal perspective was that the corporate structure of the church is such that all these individual dioceses are individual legal actors on their own. They're not connected to the Vatican in terms of responsibility for the wrongdoings that may happen in this diocese or that diocese. And then some dioceses are wealthy, like let's say the Diocese of Calgary or Toronto.
Vancouver.
But then you've got dioceses out in the rural areas that basically are very poor. And so some of these, many residential schools were located in remote areas in dioceses that would survive basically on shoestring. So argued that we don't have the money to pay. You can't, if you sue us, it'll be like suing an empty purse, you know?
There are over 70 separate legal entities representing the Catholics in Canada.
And this also fed into the Vatican not making a global apology, because they said, well, we're not responsible for all of these dioceses, which, I mean, from a strict legal perspective, one could see the argument. But in fact, for ordinary people and the survivors, they saw what they were doing and they saw the power exerted over them coming from the Catholic Church writ large.
And we knew about Pope John Paul II's apology in the South, in Ireland, Pope Francis, the apology in what country in South America?
In Ecuador.
Ecuador. So we knew that the Catholic Church had apologized to indigenous peoples and the Irish. And they were telling us, in effect, that it was impossible to do it here.
When we went to Ireland too, it was explained to us that there was a schism in the Catholic Church. There's the conservative wing and there's the more liberal wing. And that the conservative wing just said, just forget it. We deny everything. People will die. The church will carry on. The progressive side were saying, if we don't come to grips with this and deal with the reparations and the apology, the Catholic Church will die. And nobody will come to church, which in fact has been happening all over the world. So there was these two factions within the church itself. And then I think Pope Benedict, it would be safe to say, was on the conservative side, although we met with him and he did express an apology of sorts. And then Pope Francis was elected to be more on the progressive side, and he was more amenable, it seems, to the suggestion that the church had to come to grips with this.
That was a monumental, if we can go to 2022, where you were both in at Vatican City along with a group of indigenous leaders to make that appeal to the Pope in person, to as recently as that, to get an apology, leading to him coming to Canada and finally doing that. What did that mean to you, Phil?
Well, you describe it as monumental. It was once in a lifetime moment. And that apology is the first and only time we will hear the Pope apologize to Indigenous peoples from Canada. So it was a very special moment. And particularly those that have remained devout Catholics. It was like, and there was a good number of them present in St. Peter's that exalted the moment. Others less inclined saw it as a beginning of a renewal in the relationship between the Catholic Church and indigenous Catholics. As that happened, in a way that's visible, I haven't seen evidence of that myself. I mean, we're still having priests involved in very serious crimes. I mean, you had four churches built by the people, community people, that were burnt to the ground during the Kamloops
migration. And yet still, I mean, if we just coming back to Kamloops and during the whole year of the Vatican and the Pope coming here, there are still those who refuse to accept. Kathleen, those who really choose to diminish and not believe, essentially, the fact that there are children in unmarked graves because no bones have, if you will, been emerged.
Right. Well, you know, there's always been deniers. Why do they deny? Well, I think it's about creating a doubt about the guilt of the people who have done these atrocities so that, you know, they are found to be innocent in their minds. It's about self-serving, self-interest, in the sense that the wealth that's been accumulated over the centuries to make Canada one of the wealthiest countries in the world, that's been done on the backs of Indigenous peoples. If you deny that, well, then you're serving yourself in terms of justifying the privilege that white colonists have in Canada. And there's no doubt that privilege exists to this day. But the thing about it is, it's very serious. It's dangerous because if you go back in history, it was all about denial. You know, in 1850, chiefs were saying to the church and to the government, these schools aren't good. You know, 1907, Dr. Bryce was saying children are dying in huge numbers. And there was denial, right? Duncan Campbell Scott said, well, let's keep going. They buried the report. So the denialists have existed now for hundreds of years to say that there was nothing wrong with what they were doing to the Indigenous peoples. And that denialism has allowed it to continue, you see. And if we believe in never again, which was the whole purpose of the apology of Stephen Harper and Pope Francis and even Pope Benedict for sure, denialists are opening the door for it to happen again. Because if they can convince people it never happened, well, you can continue on with this discrimination and subordination and marginalization. And we see this with the murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls. I mean, what happened there? Well, the discussion was diverted to, was it genocide or wasn't it? They never come to grips with the actual happenings to these women and girls in Canada, you know? So denialism is very, very dangerous. And history proves that. So these folks that are denying without examining the evidence are not, they're doing a great disservice, not only to the Indigenous people, but to our country and to our history and to making sure that these atrocities will never happen again. You have to accept your history and deal with it. I mean, we've been through somewhat of an existential crisis in Canada, wondering, who are we? We've been taught that we're these wonderful human rights respecting citizens of a country that leads the world. But in fact, when we're confronted with these atrocities of our history, the solution is not to deny. The solution is to say, yes, we did it. And here's what we're trying to do to make sure it never happens again and to account for those things. So these denialists are not acting in the best interests either of themselves or their country, or certainly the indigenous people who deserve better, who deserve to be acknowledged and to be accounted for. I don't have any respect for the people who are engaged in this process, whether they pick on the graves or whether they pick on the stories or whether they pick on, you know, documents that they have found or pick on somebody that says, I had a positive experience. 150,000 children went to those schools. Of course, if you search hard enough, you'll find somebody that says, sure, I learned how to play hockey, or I learned to read and write, or you have to look at the whole picture in the context of what we've been talking about. You know, the terrible lies that were told, the disrespect, the breaching of the treaties, that all of those things, and the residential schools right in the middle of all of that. You have to appreciate that context.
Denying almost is like the last step in another step.
Well, sure, it's another step towards
cultural genocide,
continuing the way they have been. So if you're contented with that, that shows what kind of a person you are, I suppose, you know.
Going back to the apology at the Vatican by Pope Francis and then his visit to Canada, starting at the Muscogees and Commonwealth Stadium and Lac Saint Anne, Quebec City, and then Nunavut. The event, the moment, the private and general audience in St. Peter's was extraordinary. It was emotional. It was an emotional time, moment for many. And we were witness to a moment that we couldn't imagine it ever taking place the way it did, right? Where we had our people, in our elder, for example, praying to the Pope and his cardinals with his pipe and bestowing a name on the Pope, kissing him the forehead, and then each of us that were there, official delegates, being invited to speak a few words to the Holy Father, and then in the general audience to have Métis fiddlers, an Indian, First Nations dancer, was just absolutely marvelous. Man, it was moving. And then the Inuit singing to the Pope in their language, and one of the bishops joining them, who knew the language, also singing. And then you had the Pope there in front of us, and he had promised an apology, right? We had the document, and we looked for the words, I am sorry, and they were there, very sorry. Then he said, I'm gonna come to visit you. I'm gonna go in your homeland, and I will expand on this apology. I will have more to say, the apology. And of course he followed through on that, right? And I think there was a very deep appreciation that this was a moment in time that we had waited and pushed for such a long time, and we never thought it would be possible, especially after we'd been to see Benedict XVI, and he expressed regrets for the abuses and that had been inflicted on our people, the harms that they experienced. We didn't impose our anger on Benedict XVI. We were very guarded and cautious about what we said. And Francis, on the other hand, it was just a huge celebration, in effect, right? A celebration for the moment.
In the end, there was an incredible pilgrimage of people from Manitoba, from across this country. And after all of the pain inflicted over 100 years, it felt like a necessary step in reconciliation on that road.
The burden had been lifted. The burden had been lifted from the shoulders of thousands of our people. The Pope was there and said, I believe you. I believe your stories. And you didn't have to suffer, needlessly suffer. So we are very sorry for what the church has done to you, right? We are very sorry, even though he himself apparently couldn't speak for all of the church, right? Given the legal configuration in Canada and elsewhere. But he's recognized as the leader of the world in terms of the Catholic faith.
I think that sounds like a perfect place to end this part of our conversation. We could clearly go on. There's just so much to apologize for, so many layers to this 60 scoop, missing and murdered, so many things we will discuss as our conversations continue. But certainly the assimilation policies, there was institutionalized and there was pushback, and the fight then for Indigenous people and self-determination, which is where we will go in our next conversation.